What does Korea mean to the people of America? How does the struggle on the 38th parallel of Korea affect the lives of Americans on the 38th parallel of the United States? Here in their own words, tape recorded in their homes, at their jobs, in their churches and schools, are the people who live along the 38th parallel of the United States. We invite you to join us now in our trip across the 38th parallel, USA.
A parallel is just an imaginary line that circles the earth. It's a convenience, a tool for mapmakers. Tonight we're concerned only with one of the parallels in the United States, the 38th. Tonight we want to meet some of our neighbors and find out what the past 3 years, 3 years dominated by headlines about the Korean part of Parallel 38, have meant to them. The people you'll meet tonight have one thing in common. They all live on the 38th parallel on this continent, somewhere between Point Reyes, California, and Assateague Island, Virginia. In the next hour, we'll follow a line that starts in California, moves across Nevada, Colorado, and Utah, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Virginia. Come with us now across the 38th parallel, USA. Just east from Point Reyes and its fog-bound lighthouse following the 38th parallel is San Francisco. You stand on a waterfront dock. This is the gateway. This is a link in the chain of ships stretching from the 38th parallel in the United States to the 38th parallel in Korea. This is the port of embarkation. Here the soldiers leave for Korea, and here the soldiers come back from Korea. The Golden Gate Bridge is the last thing they see as they sail off to a war. It's the first thing those who come back see when they return. And here's where we begin, on a morning in June, when a troop ship, the U.S. General Brewster, docks with 1,234 Korean veterans aboard. That band is traditional, and so is the song, California, Here I Come. And so is a 23-year-old girl named Elsie Norwood. Elsie meets all the boats. This is her 300th. In the past 2 years, she stood on this same dock every 2 or 3 days and cut loose with her high soprano and an appropriate song. The excited dot of spectators on the dock as usual, too. The strained look, the craning of the neck, and the big smile when out of the anonymous mass of soldiers steps a son, a husband, a brother, a sweetheart. For these soldiers and these families, a perilous journey has been completed. A journey from this end of the parallel to the other end, the shooting end, and back again. To most of the people you'll hear tonight, this dock and this ritual are a dream of the future. For most of them, a morning like this one, a ship like this one, will end the hardest time of their lives. A 19-year-old California girl named Anna Glenn hopes the future holds a day like that for her. Anna lives alone in a 3-room furnished apartment in a sister community of San Francisco called Richmond. She works as a teletypist in a packing company in San Francisco. Most of her evenings are spent at home writing letters to her husband, Ray. Ray and Anna were married last August. 5 weeks later, Ray got his draft notice. Anna remembers that morning.
I stayed at home. The recruiting center was just 3 blocks from home, and he had to leave pretty early in the morning, and I had to go on to work, so I told him goodbye at home, and then I stayed around and freshened up at home, and they were good to me at work. They let me come in late. And so I just said goodbye to him at home. And he called me the second night, and I began getting letters the first week right away. But I think the whole 6 months he's been in the service, the first week was the worst. Well, I'd been used to seeing him from the day we started going together. There wasn't one day that we hadn't seen each other, even when we were engaged.
But Anna's gotten used to being alone, gotten used to not seeing Ray. Letters have become an important part of her life. She has to guard against reading between the lines, has to take the letters at face value. Reading between the lines can be dangerous for a lonely wife.
Well, I try not to too much, because that's one thing that can make you blue. When you start taking things for granted, he can say, I'm feeling fine, and some people think, well, he's just saying that to cover up.
Anna's present, just as the present of thousands of other young wives like her, is a period of waiting, of sweating it out. The long suspense, a time to be gotten through somehow. The future? The future depends on a lot of things. On truce talks, on a final peace settlement, on rotation, on luck. Anna has things pretty much under control in her own mind. The generation she was born into imposes a tough philosophy on its citizens. There are more than 5,000 miles separating Anna and Ray Glenn at this moment. They're both on the 38th parallel, but there's a lot of water and war between them. We arranged to bridge that distance. We have Anna sitting in a radio studio in San Francisco. Ray is in an Army headquarters on the 38th parallel in Korea. We placed a long-distance phone call, person to person. Anna, let's find out if Ray is on the other end.
Hello? Ray?
Yes, honey.
How are you? Huh?
I said hello again.
Hi. What do you think of all this?
Oh, this is really fabulous.
How do you look now?
What?
Have you gained any weight or anything?
I couldn't hear you, honey.
Are you in good shape? Have you gained weight or anything?
Well, I'm about the same, pretty beat up.
You haven't grown a mustache, have you?
Well, I tried that. I'm coming over on the boat.
Yeah?
Trouble is, I'm not the man I thought I was.
That's good.
How's the apartment looking?
Just fine.
I got your picture of the newly decorated kitchen.
Oh, that new picture's coming along fine. You should have seen the apartment today, though. I had both families over for dinner. We had meatloaf and everything. Can you hear me?
Oh, good, yes.
Yeah, we had a big meatloaf and everything. Uh-huh. We took a great big ply board and put it in the middle of the table to make it large and put the white linen tablecloth, and it was just huge. It looked funny, but it tasted good.
Yeah? I bet it was really good.
Yeah, I wish you could have been there.
I will be.
Well, we were thinking about you.
Yeah, don't forget it.
Forget?
I know. Just keep active.
What?
Do things, you know?
Yeah, I've been keeping busy.
The right kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I've been spending a lot of time with your folks and mine, and Bernice has come over on weekends, and I spend a lot of time with the girls at the office. They've been real good.
The time for me is passing very fast.
What?
The time for me has passed fast.
It's passed pretty fast here, too.
Well, if you're busy, it does.
Honey?
Yes?
Nothing's changed at all at home.
Just nothing what?
Huh?
Nothing what?
Everything's just like it was when you left.
That's good. Just keep it that way.
It will be.
That's for sure.
Yeah? Seems funny to go down and bowl on Wednesday nights without you now.
I'll be back in the swing sometime.
Yeah?
Better than ever.
Uh-huh.
I'll improve with age.
Well, honey.
What?
I think we'd better go now.
Okay, honey. Be good, huh?
Yeah, I'll ride every day.
God bless you, honey.
Yeah. Honey?
Yes?
You still love me?
Oh, I love you more than anything in the world.
Okay.
I'll show you when I get home.
Okay, will you be good?
Believe me.
Take care of yourself, honey.
I will, honey.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye, honey.
Bye.
Bye. Adios.
Goodbye, honey.
See you in the spring.
To Ray and the other San Franciscans fighting in Korea, Market Street is the most important thoroughfare in the world. You move along Market Street and listen to the people of San Francisco talk about Korea, about the truce, about the sacrifices the past 3 years have demanded of us.
I believe that President Eisenhower is a man to be believed and followed.
I'm interested in seeing peace, of course. But I know so little about it. I only know that The way of human dignity is to maintain it, no matter whom we're dealing with. Per se, the communists. If they don't want to go about it our way of dealing with dignity and with backing up your word, I'm afraid that we can't back down from our stand of being living, rather, and believing in human dignity.
I believe that we had to show that we meant business to Moscow, and possibly this was the least bloody way that we could show them that we meant business. I think we'll have more trouble somewhere, but I don't know whether it'll be in Korea or not. I think if we had not gone to Korea, that we could reasonably expect similar trouble to have broken out at some other point on the globe.
Market Street, San Francisco. Moving east from San Francisco, you follow the 38th parallel, USA, across the rich, fertile lands of the San Joaquin Valley. The San Joaquin Valley covers nearly 1 million acres of unbelievably fertile farmland. Its vineyards are world famous, and its flat, level land is rich in history and tradition. One of its principal cities is Stockton on an inland waterway. It's the shipping point for agricultural produce of the area. The 38th parallel goes right through the heart of Stockton, right through the living room of Mrs. Guadalupe Escoto. The parallel has cut through the life of the Escoto family in more ways than one. Her three sons have been intimately involved in it.
The first was Miguel. He was wounded in John Landing when a grenade exploded almost in his face. And he is disabled. Next is Rodolfo. Now 18, volunteered for the Marines too. He has been in Korea since January. And third is Joe. He is now at the Fort Ord.
Mrs. Escoto's prayer is a familiar one. As she says it, she's thinking of Miguel, Rodolfo, and Joe.
I pray to God he will watch over my sons and the rest of our boys, and that they will soon come back home.
Across the town from the Escoto family of Stockton live the Cavadres. Mike, the oldest son, has come back home after 15 months in Korea. Mike has two brothers, Milo, 14, and Marion, 12. Marion, the 12-year-old brother, remembers a sweating-out period he went through when his brother Mike was in Korea.
Well, sir, we didn't. For around 4 months there, we didn't get mail from him very regular. And Mama was kind of worried, but about a week later, we got a letter from him, and he told us that he got bombed by a Chinese plane that bombed the airstrip where he was stationed there in Korea.
Mike, in his brand new civilian clothes, can't quite convince himself yet that he's out of the Army, that he's back home where he can really start planning a future for himself.
Well, sir, I'm planning on getting married in not too long a period of time, and I'm working for a utilities company here in Stockton, and I plan to have a happy as life as I can and just continue on being myself.
6 miles south of Stockton on the 38th parallel is the Sharp General Depot in Lathrop, California. Here, huge military tanks and trucks are repaired, reconditioned, and sent back to fight another day. But as you stand here on the 38th parallel outside Stockton, California, and look and listen, you realize something. If the North Korean Army hadn't crossed this same 38th parallel that June day 3 years ago, this might have been just another quiet, peacetime Army installation operating with a bare minimum of personnel.
We have employed, as of Monday, 3,107 employees, and they range from a laborer to the very high skills and technical personnel, in the engineering field especially.
But that June day did happen 3 years ago, and the 3,107 employees of the Sharp General Depot are doing more than just repairing the rolling stock of a war.
We donated more than 3,700 pints of blood last year from the military and civilian employees of the depot. In fact, we are the largest, or you might say, we outshow all the supply depots in the 6th Army area as far as blood donations are concerned. It might bring out that some of the people or employees here at the depot who are in the lead in donating this blood are former Korean veterans who have returned here, are now discharged and employed at the depot, or else veterans in our battalion and stationed here of troops who have returned from Korea. They're in the first to donate their blood. They know what it means.
As you move along the 38th parallel in California, people talk. They talk about a son or a husband. They pull out letters and read them over for the 10th, 20th, or 50th time.
Dear Mom, Dad, and the kids, while I'm here at last, it sure didn't take long. 20 days on boat Randall, 5 days in Japan, 2 days on boat Hans, 2 days on the train, and now I'm in Chinchon, approximately 1 mile behind the 38th parallel. I'll be shipped to the punch bowl, wherever that is. I am in the outfit, wherever there is fighting, we go. I'm in the 5th Regimental Combat Team.
That letter is from Vernon L. Muirson, Jr. That's being read by his mother. That was the first letter with a foreign dateline. His second letter worried the family a lot. Vernon was talking about his younger brother, but his mother wondered what had happened to make him write a letter like this.
I hope Bud don't volunteer for over here. This is one hell of a country. I can't see why anybody wants to waste the time and the men for it. It sure is not worth dying in or for.
It was a long time between that second letter and the third one. A long time for Mom and Dad and the kids. When it came, the Muirson family of the San Joaquin Valley breathed a collective sigh of relief after Vernon assured them he'd been wounded only slightly.
Well, there's not much to write about, except I'm in the hospital, but we'll be back with the company in another day or so. I'll sure be glad to get back there. I get tired just laying in bed and nothing to do.
Then came the fourth letter and a change in attitude. Vernon Jr. was becoming part of an outfit and had a soldier's pride in it.
Tell Bud if he gets PCOM orders, there's not a better outfit in Korea than B Company of 5th Regimental Combat Team in Korea. Not just because I'm here either. Our platoon got shook up and rearranged, and I'm still first gunner, assistant squad leader. Guess I'll sign off for now. Your loving son, Vern Jr.
Just four letters in sequence. Four of the millions of letters. Just one of the thousands of mothers whose day is good or bad, depending upon whether or not the postman stops at the mailbox, who hope that the day will come soon when getting a letter or not getting a letter doesn't have to make the difference between life and death. Cross the California line into Nevada. Follow the 38th parallel. Cross Boundary Peak, the highest point in Nevada. You cross deserts and barren brown mountains deeply fissured with purple or rose or green. This is the land of the Gila monster and the rattlesnake, the land of the perch and the bass, the rainbow trout and the cotton-tailed rabbit, the land of mesas and canyons and unbelievable beauty. On a quiet day along the 38th parallel in Nevada, you can hear the slot machines in Las Vegas or the latest model A-bomb exploding its mushroom cloud over Yucca Flats. You pass an occasional gas station, pass signposts that say Silver Peak, Goldfield, Wheelbarrow Peak. And you come to one that says Pioche, Nevada. Pioche is one of the oldest mining towns of the West. It's quieted down a little in the past 100 years since it rang up the unbeatable record of 69 shootings before the first death from natural causes was registered. But its people still make their living in the manganese, lead, and zinc mines.
He landed in Korea on the 3rd of November. So I decided that I'd go to work at the hospital so that I wouldn't worry so much about him. So I've been working there ever since.
That's Mrs. Marion Twirley of Pioche, Nevada, talking about her eldest son, John. Mrs. Twirley's been living in Pioche for 23 years, but it's only recently that she's become something of a celebrity in the town. Most of the other 1,362 people in Pyosh know what's been happening to her son and who he's been with in Korea.
He's been wounded three times. The first time he was wounded was in February. He was taken to the hospital by the president's son, John Eisenhower. John's been with Eisenhower practically all the time that he's been in Korea. After he was in the hospital was bombed and all the boys were evicted, but they all lost all their personal belongings. John lost his Purple Heart and his Bible and all the things he had with him in the hospital.
More signposts go by as you move east across the border of Utah. More mountains. The Escalante Desert stretches prone across the parallel. And an important town to the people of this area is Cedar City, an agricultural and mining center of 6,500 people, settled by the English, Scotch, and Welsh miners to open up the coal and iron deposits. Its population was increased a year later by hundreds of families of skilled Mormon craftsmen. The city prospered, and today its location, close to Bryce Canyon, Zion Canyon, and the Dixie National Forest, make tourists a minor but important source of revenue. One of its leading citizens is Lieutenant Colonel Frank Dolly, commanding officer of the 213th Armored Field Artillery Battalion of the Utah National Guard. The battalion was sent to Korea in January of 1951. It's back now.
Not a single man of the 213th Armored Field Artillery Battalion was lost due to enemy action.
One of the members of that battalion was a 22-year-old sergeant named Klein Rollo. Klein is a newspaper man, and with his father, he edits and publishes the Iron County Record. Young Klein Rollo, in 1950, had plans for his future. At the time the National Guard unit was activated, Klein had to change some of his plans.
Of course, my wife, Pat, and I had already planned marriage as soon as I finished another year of school. But when I made the decision to join the 213th, we rushed our plans by about a year, getting married just 7 days before my activation on August 19th, 1950.
In a couple of weeks, Klein Rollo found a lot of changes in his life. He was no longer a university student. He was married. He was in the middle of a war.
That was quite a transition, and I can truly say that I hardly realized what was going on. To be taken from the campus of the University of Utah and in a matter of months find myself living in a tent in Korea was quite a change. But I found out I was first forming impressions of Korea as compared to the United States that I had just left, and the poor living standards of the people was the very first thing that I noticed. I feel that although the transition was speedy, still I acquired a vast knowledge of the ways of the world that can hardly be taught on a university campus.
But how about the people at home, you ask him? How were they? Were they aware of that other end of the 38th parallel?
While in Korea, the members of the 213th had an advantage on most troops in that they were backed 100% by the people at home. For example, people at home sent tape recordings of actual voices as well as a motion picture to we in Korea. We also sent a recording machine so that we might in turn talk to our loved ones at home. It is hard to believe the effect that this had on the morale of the men, and I believe that this high morale played a definite part in the ultimate return of all members of the 213th to their homes.
In Cedar City, you talk to a woman who has something to say about Korea based on her personal experience. Her name is Mrs. Beth Lay, and she's pretty definite in her opinions.
I've lived through the armistices of two wars, and now face-to-face with this one. I have a brother who is permanently injured from in the Aragon Forest, and I remember how thrilled I was when they signed the armistice there, thinking that peace was here to stay. I remember War II, how glad I was when we pulled out of that. I had one son, a pilot, bombing Germany when the Luftwaffe outnumbered us 10 to 1. I had another son, a pilot, in the Pacific when the invasion of the Philippines. And now Korea. The same son was called back there to leave a family to fight in Korea together with my youngest son. I had two in Korea. And they felt like that Korea was just a must, and they have no hard feelings about being there. They said that they didn't know how much good it would do, but it was the only hope we had in view of the thing we were trying to do, secure peace. And I'm just not for a quick peace in Korea. I've suffered as much sorrow, I guess, and worry as anyone else, but I'm still not sorry about it. I'm proud that I had some that wanted to make the try anyway, and I feel that way. I don't want Korea divided.
A neighbor of Mrs. Lay, Lois Woodbury, is a cashier at a bank in Cedar City. Her husband, a veteran of World War II, has been recalled to the service and is now in Korea. Mrs. Woodbury talks about a truce in Korea.
I think it might bring my husband home a little bit sooner, but truthfully, it will ease the tension and heartache on many of us that at least the bullets won't be flying over there, and that our loved ones will be able to come home maybe a month or so sooner, and that will affect our everyday lives greatly because we'll be able to maybe start all over again and settle down and have our lives the way we choose. Many people feel that if we do have a truce, a permanent peace, that it will have a depression. But to me, I think I could even take a depression better than I can take this mental strain and things that we're going through right now.
Along, along, along the Colorado Trail.
Slick Rock, Willow Gulch, the Red Mountains, the Continental Divide, Colorado. Plains, foothills, mountains, canyons, the Santa Fe Trail, the Pony Express, Colorado. You climb the parallel across the San Juan Mountains, across the range they call Sangre de Cristo, through towns called Custer, Good Pasture, Beulah, and Crow. Lying northward of the parallel is the state's second largest city, a manufacturing and trading center, a steel town. From a distance, it looks like a mirage, an oasis that will disappear when you reach it. Pueblo, seat of Pueblo County. A way station on our journey east across the 38th parallel, USA. One of the leading citizens of Pueblo, Colorado, is a soft-spoken, pipe-smoking, tweedy man named Marvin Knudsen. He is the president of Pueblo Junior College. And you ask him a big question. How have the events of the past 3 years on the 38th parallel in Korea affected the life on the quiet campus on the 38th parallel in the United States?
In the first place, there was a great feeling that perhaps there would be no more male enrollment at the college except for those people who were unable to qualify for the draft in one way or another. However, that did not prove to be the case, and after a while it was apparent that many people were going to be left and that the draft was not going to take all the possible male students. This was a great relief to many of the girls in college, and the girl enrollment also picked up as a result of that.
How about Korean veterans, Mr. Knudsen? Do you have many at Pueblo Junior College?
We have approximately 75 Korean veterans at this time. We have found this to be true practically 100% of the way, that the Korean veterans, as well as the other veterans that we've had, come back to school with more purpose. They make better students and better citizens of the community than the average run of high school graduates. We're very happy with the attitude that these people display.
We have one more question for Mr. Knudsen about his institution. How has the Korean conflict affected his students' attitude towards that other institution, marriage?
It's our general impression that the war in Korea, coupled with the World War II situation, has lowered the marriage age considerably. I don't know if that's universal but it seems to be definitely the case in this part of the country.
You follow the 38th parallel in this part of the country across Colorado. It takes you into the old covered wagon trading post town of La Junta. It takes you into a living room of a large and pleasant home. You're seated on a Davenport beside Mrs. Ralph Lopez, and you ask her the same big question. How has the Korean War affected your life?
It's taken our oldest son, Manuel Lopez. He was killed in Korea the 28th of March, 1953. He joined the service November 15, 1951. He enlisted. He was 17 years old.
As you sit on the Davenport in La Junta, Colorado, a mother begins to pick over the little memories of her dead son.
Well, I felt if it was something that he really wanted to do, that he'd do a better job doing something that he wanted to do than if he was doing something that he didn't want to do. He always wanted to study drawing and be a cartoonist. That was a thing that he liked most to do. He was a very good-natured boy. He never into much trouble. He always liked athletics awful well, play ball and all. He always liked those games awful well. And he generally brought home a blue ribbon for relay races and things like that when school was out in the spring.
Just east of La Junta, where the Arkansas River wanders back and forth across the 38th parallel, is a town called Las Animas. It's a community of 4,000 in the heart of a rich agricultural and cattle-raising country. You visit the newspaper office of the Las Animas Leader and talk to its editor and publisher, Mr. R.P. McDermott. Mr. McDermott's been newspapering for 32 years, and he has an opinion about that war on the other end of the 38th parallel.
Well, I guess I would describe it as an unpopular war. If we haven't been sold on the thing, you might say. The boys, they're called and they go, and 18 months, 2 years later, they come back. So I think it's the other war was, it meant more. We were defending something. In this war, we don't know just exactly what we're doing. I think that about covers it.
As Editor McDermott sees it, that covers it. You move east from Las Animas toward Fort Lyon. You come to an old wooden building. This is the Lakeville School of Benton County. And as you walk into its 7th and 8th grade classroom, you discover that the 38th parallel has invaded the geography lesson.
Our lesson this morning is a very appropriate one, and it deals with the lands lying along the 38th parallel. This parallel has been stamped most vividly on the minds of the people of the world by the Korean invasion. Heretofore, we thought nothing of the 38th parallel. We thought in terms of 90, 80, 70, and on.
To most of the children in Amelia Christensen's class at Lakeville School in Benton County, Colorado, the lesson on the 38th parallel has a singular meaning. Uncles, brothers, cousins, fathers have gone, will go, have come back, or will come back, or won't come back. Mrs. Christensen is a school teacher presiding over a routine geography class on a warm afternoon. She is also a mother, whose son John has just returned from Korean service. Geography has a way of becoming personal. From Benton County, you follow the parallel across Prowers County and into Hamilton. You've done more than just cross a county boundary. You've gone across another state line, and you're in Kansas.
Bury me not on the lone prairie, where the wild coyotes will howl o'er me, where the rattlesnakes hiss and the wind blows free. Oh, bury me not on the lone prairie.
Some people call it the breadbasket, the exact center on the 38th parallel in the United States, Kansas. The western part contains a short grass pasture, wheat fields, and sandy soil. Geologists will explain to you that the sandy soil is the direct result of the grinding of the glacial boulders of the Rocky Mountains in the waters of an ancient inland sea. This is the land of winter wheat. The summer sun is too hot to nourish the summer wheat. This is, primarily, one-crop country. But lately, oil has been turning up, and competing with wheat is the principal product. Cities are few and far between. It's a land of farms and villages. The names of the towns are part of the colorful past of the country. Cimarron, Dodge City, Pawnee Rock, Rattlesnake. Where the Arkansas River dips southward stands one of the large cities of the 38th parallel USA, Wichita. In Wichita, you stop at a huge, sprawling factory.
Here at Wichita, we are producing the 92.5-ton swept-wing B-47 Stratojet in quantity for the U.S. Air Force.
You're talking to Earl Schaefer, vice president of the Boeing Aeroplane Company.
More than 400 of these Boeing-designed medium bombers have been produced to date. Presently, we are producing them at the rate of one per working day.
And for security reasons, that's all Mr. Schaefer will tell you. You meet a salesman named Larry Cotton in Wichita. He looks at truce in Korea in terms of his own job.
It'll probably have some reaction, some very definite reaction, in the business world. Perhaps more competition. And in such case, it will mean a little harder work for the salesman in order to keep the present economy where it is.
You move across the 38th parallel USA, crossing Kansas, along U.S. Highway 75 to Burlington. Reverend Carl Ducer, pastor of the First Methodist Church in Burlington, Kansas, is a pleasant host, a thoughtful, quiet man.
Well, some of our boys have returned from the Korean War front and have been, some of them been severely wounded. Our boys have been somewhat disturbed as to their future outlook, and because of their interrupted college education, plans for marriage, and plans for going into business. Of course, we realize here, as they do nearly everywhere, that this war is a necessary evil, as to protect our freedoms and to stop the progress of communism throughout the world.
Then you talk shop with the Reverend Ducer.
Probably it has had a demoralizing effect. War nearly always has. We don't have very much of the backwash from low morals in our community here.
Still in Burlington, you talk to John Redmond. He's the publisher of the Daily Republican.
We in this community, in my opinion, have got through this war with fewer losses and fewer heartbreaks than in either of the previous. In the World War I, for instance, our local battery was in the thick of the heavy fighting in the Argonne, and we lost more than 20 men in that one battle. We have had comparatively few deaths during this Korean War, and so far as I can recall, we have had no one captured.
Away, I'm bound to go across the wide Missouri.
You move with the 38th parallel across another state border, across into the Ozark Hills, the land of the inevitable threesome, the rabbit, the gun, and the dog, Missouri. In the Missouri Ozarks, Ernie Williams owns a boat dock, a guide service, and a coffee shop in the heart of the vacation belt. Ernie listens a lot to his customers and the things they talk about.
The biggest talk you get about the war down here is a father and mother will come in here with a young fellow and say, "Well, I want the very best I can buy for this boy because this is his last week. He's got his call. He's going to leave next week for Korea." And mother will come in here with a young fella and say, "Well, I want the very best I can buy for this boy because this is his last week. He's got his call. He's going to leave next week for Korea."
And does Ernie Williams think these Missouri boys ought to be sent to Korea? Have they gained anything by it?
Personally, I'd say no, because down here you get awful close to your mankind. You live with these boys, and you live in their homes, and you make it possible for them to live down here, and we hardly think so. Some of these boys are coming back and boogered up in pretty bad shape, and they're never going to be of much use anymore.
You move across the Ozarks following the parallel. You pass Cuba, Sullivan, DeSoto. You're headed for St. Louis. And in the outskirts of that metropolis, you stop at a house on a side street where Mrs. Riller Warren sits waiting for her son Vernon to come home.
Vernon was fine in school, and he really was crazy about basketball. He'd play basketball, and he was very apt in all his studies.
When Vernon first went to Korea, he wasn't much of a correspondent.
When I first heard from him in 1952, he wrote me a letter himself. And then I got a letter every month until about September, about the middle of September in 52, and then I didn't get any more mail in until he returned back from with the sick and wounded prisoners.
Vernon was one of the wounded prisoners recently exchanged by the communists. He is now in Valley Forge Hospital and will be there yet for a while. What did he write about while he was in prison camp?
Well, he only just wrote and said, "Mama, I'm well, I'm doing fine, I'm a prisoner of the Chinese people. Saying I hope to come home soon as war is a peace."
And what was Mrs. Warren's reaction when she discovered that her son was being freed?
Well, I don't know what the reaction was, but I was so happy I couldn't tell anything what went on about. But I really was happy.
And what about that day in the future when Vernon comes home from Valley Forge Hospital?
Well, I intend to have a welcome home coming for him with chickens and drinks and so forth on for him when he gets in to meet a lot of his friends and neighbors.
A welcome homecoming for him with chicken and drinks to meet a lot of his friends and neighbors. You cross the Mississippi River at St. Genevieve and follow the parallel across the state line into Illinois, the southern tip. And you find yourself in the farmhouse of Mr. and Mrs. John Camel of Carmi, Illinois. The 3 years since 1950 have made a big difference in their lives. And they sit and tell you about their 23-year-old son, Lewis.
Lewis went into the service, went into his training in 1950, and entered the service then in 51, and was killed
November the 18th, 1952.
Lewis was 23 years old. Lewis was a farmer. Lewis loved to farm, and he owned his own equipment, had plenty of it, but that didn't make any difference. And Uncle Sam called for him. He went. He went willingly and made a good soldier. And, of course, he always longed to be home, longed to be free, to do as he pleased here on his farm, and also was to be married on his return home. Of course, all these hopes and expectations were ended over there when he was killed.
That now is part of the remembered past. And the future?
Well, we're going right ahead. We were fortunate in securing the services of a boy about, well, younger than Lewis, but a very good boy, and we sure appreciate his help, and we're going right ahead. We have increased, bought bigger machinery so we could make more time. And
We brought our older son home, and he and the other boy, Bert and Ralph, and their father's going ahead with the farming.
Lewis is gone, but the farm goes on. In White County, Illinois, further east on the 38th parallel, there's a town of 1,500 inhabitants, a town called Norris City. Frank Bailey, who lives on RFD number 3 outside of Norris City, is back from the wars, but he figures Korea played a big part in a big decision he made.
I got married since I got out of service. You know, I had the top sergeant in the service, so I figured if I got out, I couldn't live without one, so I just got married.
What are his future plans?
Well, right now I'm helping my father on the farm and selling automobiles on the side. It's, that's another thing that brings up. When these guys come home from the service and you see them standing around down by the pool room and all that, and they'll think, well, look how the service ruined him. Try to figure that guy's got, he goes through a lot. And when he comes home, it's just like a change in his life. It takes a lot of time to get reconciliated.
Hard by the border separating Illinois from Indiana on the 38th parallel USA is Evansville, Indiana. Here you meet a druggist named Francis Britt. Francis Britt is chairman of Draft Board 81 in Evansville, and he spends 5 hours a week at his work.
There's been a lot of publicity of the fact that the well-to-do boys go to college and the poor boys go to Korea. And I'd like to say in defense of the boys that go to college that when they graduate, they're down there ready to go. They don't want any further deferments. They want to do their part. And in looking over our records, I noticed that in this last year, we've taken 6 boys that have completed their law course and have gone on to the service.
Evansville, Indiana is an important rail center. In the freight yard, the boxcars and flat cars move westward, their cargo bound for the Pacific coast, and from there as far as Korea. Harold Drews, general yard master for the C&EI, that's the Chicago and Eastern Illinois Railroad, spots some of the freight passing through.
Shell casings manufactured by Servel. Aeroplane wings, which are manufactured by Seeger. The Albert Ross hulls for the aeroplane, which are manufactured by Chrysler Corporation.
Shell casings by an air conditioner manufacturer. Aeroplane wings by a refrigerator concern. Hulls for aircraft by an automobile company. From the railroad yard in Evansville, you thread your way through a busy street corner, the corner of 3rd and Main. You stop Urban Faust, an office manager. And you ask him, what was all the shooting about in Korea?
Well, now I'll tell you, I haven't followed that close enough to give a real intelligent answer. I did at first, and it drug on so long, and the newspapers were just so filled of this and that side of the story and the various opinions that I just haven't caught right up to date with it, kept up to date with it, and I couldn't give you a good, intelligent answer of why we are fighting in Korea.
You stop another passerby, Joe Reardon, who works in a large Evansville office.
My sincere belief is that it was a necessity more than desire on anybody's part to actually show Russia and its satellite nations, the communists, that we really meant business this time, and we were not going to wait as we did in the late 1930s until such time as practically half the world was gone before we stood up on our haunches and said, well, it's high time this thing stopped. I don't believe that we can just all of a sudden quit now and say we've won in Korea. We're definitely going to have to keep our defenses up. I mean, keep our production up in war materials and keep prepared in case the war should break out someplace else.
Going east from Evansville, you follow the 38th parallel past the Nancy Hanks Lincoln Memorial, through a town called Santa Claus, Indiana, and you cross into Kentucky, the northern tip of it. Here is West Point, Kentucky. Here is Coral Ridge in the bluegrass country. And you move with the parallel to Louisville, and you stop a man on the street and ask about the reason for Korea and the effect of the truce meetings.
I think it comes down to a matter of ideology. On one side, you have communism. On the other side, the freedom that we enjoy. And I don't think anyone worries about which is the right one, freedom. I don't think we can forget about it. I don't think anyone can forget about communism and its march across the world. I think a truce might slow down the advance of communism, but I don't think we can forget about it. I think somebody has to stop communism, and it might as well be us.
Moving east across Kentucky, through the bluegrass, through the coal areas, through towns called Lexington and Bourbon and Winchester, 5 miles east of Winchester is the home of Mrs. Lee Wheeler Bean. She calls her home Hideaway House, because in the summer the foliage hides it from the view of the road. Mrs. Bean is the aunt of Private James Pruitt.
He went in service so young that he had just been to school until that time and on the farm when he wasn't in school. First to the country school, the grade school near our home, and then to the Clark County High School in Winchester. He left school so young.
Private James Pruitt, missing in action in Korea since May 18, 1951. The people of Charleston, West Virginia, won't forget the 38th parallel. 3 years ago, the 167th Fighter Squadron, a National Guard unit made up of men from the Charleston area, was activated. It went into training for service in Korea. In April of 1951, the 167th had its first casualty. Major Woodford Sutherland, Jr. was killed in a training accident at an Air Force base in Florida. His body was brought home to Charleston for burial. Two plane loads of his buddies were flown in to act as pallbearers. On April 8, 1951, a foggy Sunday morning, the first of these planes approached Charleston's Kanoa Airport. It never made it. It crashed.
We were sitting at the table eating dinner, and we heard the plane crash. So we ran up there. First, though, my sister went to get help, and me and my brother-in-law, we went on the hill to see what we could do. And we heard two men hollering help. And we went up there, and as I brought them off the hill while my brother-in-law went back to the plane to see if he could help anyone. Oh, they were awful. Their eyes were burnt. They said they couldn't see. And they were, nose was bleeding, and all the skins off their hand, off their top of their heads and everything.
All I have to say is, after 17 years, this is the worst disaster I've ever had to photograph.
All 21 of the men in the plane died. There were no survivors. In 1 week, 22 Charleston men had become war casualties. 2 days later, a memorial service for the 22 victims is held in the municipal auditorium in Charleston.
Let not your heart be troubled. You believe in God. Believe also in me. In my Father's house are many mansions.
If it were not so, the families of the men, their wives, their mothers, their children, listen in the large auditorium. Listen and remember.
And prepare a place for you. I will come again.
Going east from Charleston, you cross the Allegheny Mountains on the border of West Virginia and Virginia, past Natural Bridge, Devil's Knob, Bald Knob, through the Shenandoah Valley, across the Blue Ridge Mountains, the land of apples, beef, and poultry, the cradle of presidents, the birthplace of Washington, Jefferson, Lee, the Virginia Military Institute, VMI. And here at VMI, you talk to Major General William H. Milton, Jr., the superintendent.
Practically all members of the first class of 1953 will enter a branch of the service, either artillery, infantry, armor, air force, or Marine Corps as a commissioned officer. Some with regular commissions, some with reserve commissions. They all realize that there's a high degree of probability that before this year's out, they will be assigned to duty in Korea. Of course, the casualty lists in Korea are very slow in getting back to us here at the Institute. We know of 22 killed, as of the moment that I'm speaking, ranging from second lieutenants to lieutenant general.
Another war has added to VMI's distinguished roster of her sons killed in action. You've traveled eastward along the 38th parallel USA. You pass through Charlottesville, birthplace of Robert E. Lee, the campus of the University of Virginia, across the Anna River, the Mattapani, the Rappahannock. And east of the Rappahannock, you stop at a diner. As the waitress removes the coffee cup from your table, she notices the newspaper you've been reading. She points to a story with a Korean dateline.
I think what happens in Korea affects all of us, whether we have sons, husbands, or fathers over there fighting. It really doesn't make very much difference. It's not just a war, funny names of places. You can't just write it off as a brawl. It's over and done with. You have to remember it and keep it from happening again somewhere else.
We said at the outset of this program that the voices we heard would have one thing in common, that they belonged to people who all lived on the 38th parallel USA. Perhaps there's something else they have in common, too. Maybe those voices underlined an inescapable truth, that what happens to men and women of the 20th century anywhere affects the lives of men and women of the 20th century everywhere. That a shot fired on the 38th parallel in Korea somehow wounds a farmer 5,000 miles away on the 38th parallel in Illinois. And that in a world shrunken in size, there is, more than ever, the need for men of stature. And now, good night.
You have just heard 38th Parallel USA with Will Rogers, Jr. as narrator. A report tape recorded in their own homes, their jobs, their churches and schools of the people who live along the 38th Parallel of the United States.